So we are Wednesday, April 29th, and we're at our normal 11:10 lecture time. And I sent out a quiz on email just about 10 minutes ago. So you guys all have a new quiz to do, and it is intended to be a group quiz. So this is a quiz that I would have given in class where it was intended to be in a group setting. And I thought about trying to do it in breakout rooms and having you guys do it and take up class time. And I thought, no, I'll just turn it loose. Trying to do breakout rooms and all of that got a little fancier than what I feel like I'm capable of managing right now. So the quiz is mailed out. You have over the weekend until Monday. I was initially going to just do it from Monday to Wednesday, and then I realized, no, today's Wednesday already. So our next meeting is Monday. So just take over the weekend. And it's a two-page quiz. There's two problems to it. And like I said, it's meant to be worked together. So go ahead and make some Zoom meetings and get together and talk it over and see if you guys can come to a consensus on what you think the answers are to that quiz. That'll be fun. Also, the next co-op, you should start the next co-op. Those next co-op problems are there's some good carbocation problems that are in there. So that's an appropriate thing to start up now as well. And what we're going to finish today is we're going to finish chapter 7 today and move on into chapter 8. So we'll finish chapter 7, which is our SN1 and SN2. We'll finish looking at some of the SN1 problems today with kinetic versus thermodynamic. And then we will pick up with chapter 8 today, which is elimination reactions. And so we'll start those elimination reactions. So lots of good stuff happening today, okay? I feel like we're missing a few people because, we're missing a few people. I see 19 in and I'm in twice, which means that there's only 17 people in here. Usually I've got two screens and more people than that filling up my screens. But we also know that this is being recorded and that they can access it asynchronously if they so desire. So let's go ahead and just jump into where we left off. And I'm trying to think where we actually left off. So maybe I should go back and look at the lecture notes. This was not, did I not update online yesterday? I thought I did. But these look like the sulfolysis reactions. We went through, we did all the carbocation stuff, and we ended up, it needs to go away. We ended up doing a few examples of which reaction was faster. And then we were doing some carbocation rearrangements. We looked at the alkyl shifts, we looked at strain relief. We looked at reminding everybody that that all of these driving forces for these hydride shifts and alkyl shifts are based on the same stability forces that we were studying when we were studying acid base, such that they are electronegativity, hybridization, resonance, size, and induction. And I just had a little note up here that I was looking at those pKa values. And really, what I had underlined here was that resonance is one of our big keys. It's really going to be resonance and induction because size had to do with the element in which the positive charge was occurring on. And these are all carbocations, so it's all carbon. So size really doesn't come into play. Nor does electronegativity or hybridization come into play because they're all carbons with carbocations on them. So they're all sp2 hybridized carbons with three different groups on them and the positive charge. So really it comes down to two factors, resonance and induction. And those are our stabilizing factors that we're looking at. So we're gonna pick that up today. We're gonna look at a few more examples today and we're gonna talk about kinetic versus thermodynamic in terms of products and see where we go from there. So I didn't start a new note yet, so let's do that. And let's look at an example of a chemical reaction. So this is an alkene that has an iodine in it, and this is a sulfolysis reaction. So we'll do it in methanol with a little bit of heat. And And let's go through that reaction mechanism of what actually happens here. So in the first step, what's going to happen is the iodine is going to come off. So this is our SN1 sulvolysis reaction. And as the iodine comes off, it leaves behind the carbocation. And then we need to look and say, well, which direction is this reaction going to go? There's two possible shifts that can occur. So let's look at those two possible shifts. There is a proton, which is sitting here, which we'll call HA. And there is two protons, which are sitting on this adjacent carbon, which we'll call HB. And we could have shift of either one of these hydrogens to leave or to produce a more stable carbocation. So if we look at the shift of HA, so we'll say 1,2 hydride, and this is looking at HA shifting, then as HA shifts, I get a new carbocation that is a tertiary carbocation, and HA is now shifted into a new location. So we went from what was a secondary carbocation to what is now a tertiary carbocation. So that's good, that's more stable. Let's try and look at what happens if I shift HB. And some of these, you just need to draw them to see what's happening. So we're gonna do a 1,2 hydride, looking at moving HB. And so HB is going to shift instead of HA. And what that's going to do is give me a new possible carbocation, where the carbocation is now in that location, HB is now attached there. And this is a secondary carbocation, but it's secondary allylic. And what secondary allylic means is that I have resonance in this carbocation. And that resonance helps to make this carbocation more stable than a tertiary carbocation. So allylic carbocations, remember that resonance is a greater factor than induction by a huge degree. So when we were thinking about acid bases, let's do just a little reminder here, that when we looked at acid base chemistry, we said that resonance was a factor that can increase the stability. And we measured increase in stability by how it affected the pKa value in lowering the pKa value, essentially, and lowering the acidity constants. And so we said that resonance was somewhere around 15 to 20 pKa units in terms of stabilization, and that induction gave us sort of 0.2 to maybe 2 pKa units at best. So it's orders of magnitude more important, resonance is, than induction is. So even a primary allylic carbocation would more than likely be more stable than a tertiary carbocation because of the resonance stabilization that is kicking in here. So this secondary allylic, this is more stable. So you have to look for resonance. It's really important to look for resonance as opposed to looking for the induction and just always going for the tertiary carbocation or the more substituted carbocation. We need to make sure that we're looking for a carbocation that is more stable through resonance if we can find it in that regard. All right, and so what comes out of this is two products, but primarily the two products that are by the 1,2 hydride shift. So my nucleophile being methanol, the methanol can now come in and attack. Let's do methanol in purple. I can get the methanol attacking at the primary position, or I can get the methanol attacking at the secondary position. So those two different things And we can call these two different products A and B. So let's make this one A, product A, and we'll make this one product B. That I get two different products that come out of this from these two different resonance contributors. And I know that I'm not doing all of the mechanism, and we can do the rest of the mechanism, but it's just a deprotonation step that I wind up getting methanol attached at that position. And I get methanol wind up being attached at the primary position. And that these are the two products that come from A and from B. And out of these two products, one of them is major. This one, A, is the major product. And we'll need to look at that and look at why that's the major product. But in part, it comes out of the fact that this reaction is being heated. And so let's take this reaction. And we'll copy this and put it down here. So this will be our closer look. Out of these two products that we're seeing, as we said, A and B, we said one was major. A is major, B is minor. And these products, one of them is the thermodynamic product. And the other is the kinetic. Now, we've used thermodynamic and kinetic just briefly before. We didn't really spend a whole lot of time talking about them. So what we need to do is we need to take and make an energy diagram and show how one of these is kinetic and how one of these is thermodynamic. Let's take a look at the resonance carbocation for a minute and focus on that. So when we go back to the carbocation, so there's two parts in understanding this thermodynamic nature. We need to understand the carbocation and we need to understand the products. When we look at the carbocation had the positive charge here and the resonance contributor, or I should say the second resonance contributor, where the carbocation is on the primary. So just thinking about the carbocation itself, I have secondary versus primary in terms of where the charge actually exists. It is more stable to have the charge in a secondary position than the primary position based on having more electron donating groups. So this is the major resonance contributor. That makes the other one minor. And accordingly, when I take and I combine these resonance contributors together, what that means is that I'm looking at something that has a charge that is distributed over the two centers, but the charge is larger at the second center than it is at the primary center. So this contributes more. So this is the overall sort of carbocation where that charge is split between the two, but it's not split equally. It's split with the greater charge over the secondary center. And what that means is that that this is the larger electrophile. It's the larger target. But while that's the larger target, it has more sterics around it. The primary center is a smaller target, but it has more sterics, or less sterics. Smaller target, but less sterics. So as I have an incoming nucleophile that is going to attack this, an incoming nucleophile in looking at these two places is going to see more sterics in trying to get to the secondary center than it is in trying to get to the primary center. What that does is it makes the primary center have a lower activation energy for being able to get at the primary center. So we have a lower activation energy. Lower E sub A for attack at primary. Okay, let's look at the products for a second. We've analyzed sort of the carbocation. Let's take a closer look at the products. There were two products that came out of this. One product had the double bond on the terminal end, and the other product had the double bond internally. So this double bond here, and I know we haven't had this part yet, but this double bond is what is called monosubstituted. This is something that we hit very heavily in the next chapter, but we're going to talk about it right now anyway. It's monosubstituted. So when we talk about a double bond can be monosubstituted. A double bond can be disubstituted in a number of different ways. So we can have disubstituted. Let's do it this way. Let's turn this around. Let's make a list. So we can have it unsubstituted. We can have monosubstituted. We can have disubstituted in a couple of different formats. So these are all disubstituted. And then we can have trisubstituted. And we can have quad substituted. And they tend to go in order of increasing stability, with the more substitution that you have. So when you think about a double bond, the double bond is a pi bond. It has electron density above and below that form the pi orbitals. Each group that you add into it becomes an electron donating group that feeds electron density into the pi bond. The more electron density that you have in the pi bond, the stronger the double bond and the more stable the double bond is. It is also true that the more substituted that we get, or the more branched that we get, the more stable a molecule becomes with branching. And so you can think of this also in terms of the amount of branching. A molecule becomes more stable in terms of its branching because you have a higher electron density and you are optimizing your nuclear electron attractions in a higher branched molecule, and the molecule becomes more thermodynamically stable in that branched format, much in the same way that we're looking at a double bond being more thermodynamically stable the more substituted the double bond is. So with electron donating groups attached to the double bond becomes more stable. Where I have a series of disubstituted ones, they are organized in order of increasing stability in that there are sterics between the disubstituted where the two groups are on the same terminal end of the double bond. And there are sterics where the groups are cis on the double bond, with trans being the most stable, where the groups have the farthest distance apart. So we go in order of increasing stability from unsubstituted to monosubstituted to disubstituted to trisubstituted to quad substituted. So the more substituted the double bond is, the more thermodynamically stable the double bond becomes. When we take that and apply that to our substitution patterns of our products, this monosubstituted idea here is telling me that this double bond in the first product is monosubstituted. The double bond in the second one is disubstituted. And the dye substituted then is more stable. And we'll say more thermodynamically, stable. Okay, so what does that mean when we put all of those things together? Let's take and make an energy diagram of our chemical reaction and then put all these different factors into it and see how these factors are relating to one another. So we'll draw a big energy diagram because we want to kind of fit in all of this stuff. And we're going to start off with our reactant. And maybe I'll move our reactant up a little bit so we get room for our products to fit our products in here. Okay, and our reactant had the iodine that was going to come off. And we're going to go up to a carbocation. And the carbocation that we're going to go to is a resonance stabilized carbocation. And that carbocation has the positive charge here. And we'll look at the resonance contributor with the carbocation there. Okay, so there's our carbocation. And our activation energy is for the formation of that carbocation. And that was our rate determining step, was that step. But now, as we go into looking at these two different products, the two products that we get are, one is more stable than the other. So when we look at the methanol attacking, we get the more stable product has the more substituted double bond. So here's the methanol attached at our more stable product. And we have a product that is a little bit less stable, that has the methanol attached in that position. So here's one product and here's the other product. The formation for each one of these products, while they come from a single carbocation, have different activation energies because of the sterics for the nucleophile coming in and attacking each product. So when I look at the sterics of a nucleophile, the methanol in particular, coming in and attacking the first material, the sterics are fairly low here. But when I have the methanol coming in and attacking the carbocation, which is the second one, the sterics are fairly high there. So I have two different activation energies for the reaction going to each one of these products. For the reaction going to, let's see, which product did I label A and B? I think I labeled this one A and this one B. So going to A, I have a high activation energy going to A. And going to B, I have a lower activation energy going to B. So essentially what's happening, and I want to move all of this over, scooch that I've got room for my activation energies in here to be able to go to my products. So what's happening is I'm getting an activation energy that is low, that is taking me to this product, and an activation energy which is high, which is taking me to this product. So let me fit those and look at coloring these to match. So my low activation energy here is going to be blue, and my high activation energy due to my sterics here is going to be red. And that's in part due to the sterics that are happening there and leading to each product. So higher sterics make a higher activation energy. And the lower steric over here, if I've done everything correctly, make for a lower activation energy. However, it's not working out exactly the way, because this product is looking like it's both fast to form and lower sterics, and is looking like kinetic and thermodynamic. And maybe I didn't think that through entirely before I presented it. And I need to think through if I'm actually making an error there, and I don't think I did. I think it's presented the way that I want it. Okay, I explained to the morning class this morning that this was not my best day. Not what you want to hear, but actually I think it looks okay. So while I had labeled one kinetic and one thermodynamic before, it's looking like, based on the sterics and based on the substitution pattern, that it's actually both kinetic and thermodynamic for the major product to be the bottom one. So when we look at the transition state, what we're saying is that the transition state is telling me about the speed of the reaction. So this happens fast. Due to low activation energy. And then we also look at which product is most stable. And sometimes we get into a situation where a transition state energy is high, and yet we get a very stable product. That's a situation where we get kinetic versus thermodynamic, that usually what happens is we get from a chemical reaction a low activation energy and then a high activation energy, but a more stable product. This product here is normally labeled the kinetic product, and this one the thermodynamic. And they are obtained in different ways. So this thing, the activation energy for the kinetic is small, and so this product forms fast. It forms at low temperature.
Jason?
Yeah.
On this example, in my notes from last year or whenever I took it, you had this one as, and it was, there was a different thermo and kinetic. You had the one, yeah, you had it opposite.
Yeah, no, I'm playing with it because I think that what I did last time is I went with the, partial positive charge as being the greater electrophile. And I think I just went with it as the greater electrophile and ignored the sterics. And I think—
Okay, I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think I made a mistake. And I think— Okay. And I think that where I got into my mistake, okay, I know what to do. Let me unconfuse everybody, including myself. Sterics. Let's talk sterics for a second. Sterics are important when you have something like an SN2 reaction where the material has a tetrahedral sp3 hybridized carbon. In this case, when the nucleophile is incoming and trying to encroach in here, and we have different R groups that are outside, these R groups form sterics because of their bond angles and because of their ability to crowd and also about free rotation, about the sigma bonds that take these groups and spin them around like a little rotor. So sterics really happen and build up and are important around sp3 centers. When we get to a carbocation, and this is the part where I faked myself out and I should have listened to the warning bells going off in my head. When we get to a carbocation, the carbocation is sp2 hybridized. It's flat. It's trigonal planar. And because of its trigonal planar, even though if I have R groups out around the sides, they do add to the sterics a bit, but an incoming nucleophile doesn't really see them because it's approaching from the top or the bottom from the flat plane. So you can think about this thing as being sort of in its flat plane, and that those sterics really don't affect much the incoming nucleophile. So where I got caught up in the sterics at primary versus secondary, I lost track of the idea that it was a carbocation and faked myself out. So this is a good point that even when you know what you're talking about, sometimes when you're on autopilot, you can mess things up. So so let's straighten it back out and let's take the idea and go back to the notes back here. And where I said larger electrophile, more sterics, and we're gonna get rid of some of these ideas and we're gonna correct this and not worry so much about the sterics. And we're gonna go with what I started to do, which was the larger electrophile. And the larger electrophile is going to be my larger target. And the smaller electrophile is gonna be the smaller target. So basically what's gonna happen is, because there is a smaller partial positive charge on this side, the activation energy for hitting this side is going to be larger. So larger activation energy due to smaller electrophile. It's just essentially the smaller electrophile. And the other one is going to have a smaller activation energy due to the larger electrophile. Just the large partial positive. Okay, in that context, let's go back and change these lines around and get rid of my sterics idea. And get rid of these guys. And now we can do kinetic versus thermodynamic. And now this is probably more appropriate. Okay, but that also means I need to change my color schemes because my color schemes are now all wonky. So we'll make this one red. And we'll make this one blue. Red for higher energy, blue for lower energy. Okay, and now we're better off. And now what we'll do is we will form these transition states such that the high activation energy for the primary and the low activation energy and what I need to do is I need to get them separated to be able to draw my diagram appropriately. And we'll take this guy and we'll move him over here. And we'll take this guy and move him over to the other side. And now my diagram's gonna look better. So he's lower energy, we'll leave him down there. And our low activation energy comes here to this product, and our high activation energy comes over to this product. Okay, now we're in better stance. And now this is the kinetic product that happens fast. This is at low temp and low reaction times or short reaction times. The other one is called the thermodynamic. And the thermodynamic is favored by, let's get rid of this because now my diagram actually does reflect this. And that's just in my way. So now this is the thermodynamic. And it happens more slowly. But it happens at high temps and longer reaction times. And let's zoom out so we can see that whole image. Okay, so what's going on here is that this product, that is the thermodynamic product, accumulates. Over time, and is what we call like a thermodynamic sink. Although thermodynamic, is that going to fit in there? Dynamic sink. By calling it a thermodynamic sink, what we basically say is that if I'm heating this chemical reaction and I get to this transition state, the first product that winds up forming when there's a small amount of energy in the system is the kinetic product. And the kinetic product has a smaller activation energy to go back to the activated complex, back to the intermediate, the carbocation intermediate. And because this one has a lower energy for going back to the carbocation intermediate, that methyl group, the methoxy group that added to it, can pop back off and it can go back to here. And as it goes back to here, and there's enough energy in the system to make it over the larger activation energy barrier, you can form the thermodynamic product. The thermodynamic product goes back less. So essentially what we're saying is that because of the activation energy here, that there is an equilibrium where this guy goes back and forth. However, this one has its formation, but doesn't go back very much. And so while they're bouncing back and forth, if you think of having 100 spheres in here, eventually all of the products, or initially, all of the products start building up over here. But what winds up happening is as this product accumulates, they're bouncing back, and every once in a while, one bounces over to this side. And every time one of these bounces over to the other side, it can't go back. And so they wind up just accruing on this side of the equation. And it happens until they're almost all gone. And so because this reaction, all the way back over here, was run under heat, that heat is telling me that this is thermodynamic conditions. And that I am expecting to get the thermodynamic product. If I had run this under colder conditions or under a short amount of time, I could try to select for the kinetic product and try to make the kinetic product the major product. Let me show you another example that maybe makes this a little bit more clear. Okay, so first off, I apologize for creating confusion. Second off, it's never really a bad thing because it allows me to back up and slow down and correct things. And third, it's also a really good thing because I'm human and I make mistakes just like everybody else. And once in a while, when I get on a tangent and I get going and I think I'm doing the right thing in my head, sometimes I can convince myself I'm doing the right thing when I'm not. And it's worth it to back up when the warning bells are going off and say, what the heck did I do wrong, and get it fixed. So it's never a bad thing to have you guys see me mess up and tank. I'm just as human as everybody else. So that happens. Thank you, Linnea, for pointing that out and making sure and getting me back on track. That was awesome. And how are we all doing? Let's just check in real quick before I go through the next example that makes this a little bit clearer. Okay, cool. Everybody's with me. Nice.
We can just disregard the last reaction that you did.
No, don't disregard it, Finn. I've corrected it. So the notes are all corrected. So the notes are now correct. And the explanation is correct in the notes, so don't disregard it. Let me give you another example that highlights it and supports it. So let's do it that way.
Hey, Jason?
Yes.
What about from earlier? There there was that when we were comparing which way it would go for the
And it was one more product.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where is that product, right?
Yeah. Was there any product made with that one?
Yes, but it would be a minor product. So let's put that product into our energy diagram too and see where that product would go. So if I want to put that product into our energy diagram and we want to talk about that one, I have to move the energy diagram down and make room for it, because that product had a higher activation energy. So we would go all the way up and we would go to an intermediate that initially was the secondary product, and then down to this product. So what we did is we lost that. We lost that carbocation here, and then we had the hydride transfer over, which then gave the tertiary carbocation, and then we would have the methanol attack at that position, and we would go down to a product that would be way down from there. So we'll just keep taking that down, and that would go down to another product. But that is higher in activation energy because of the tertiary carbocation that we're creating that is not as stable as the allylic carbocation. So yes, Elian, that's a good question. You would see some product from that, but it would be less than these two products.
So I have a question.
Okay, Eric.
Would there potentially be a fourth product with this behaving like an SN2 reaction, where the iodide ion leaves at the same time as a methanol nucleophile attacks that carbocation?
Also a good question. And in essence, what winds up happening is we have SN2, SN1, eliminations, E2, and E1. And these reactions for any particular substrate will have different activation energies, unimolecular for the SN2 and unimolecular for the E2. For the SN1 and the E1, they would be bimolecular. And I don't exactly know how I want to construct it in my head, but the energy diagrams for each one of these coexist at the same time, so that I could look at any particular substrate. Maybe I could do it this way. I could look at any particular substrate and I could look at the SN2 transition state. I could look at the E2 transition state, which would take me let's do it this way. Josh does them this way, and I always like it when Josh does it this way, although I very rarely do it myself this way. So let's make this the substrate and the SN2 reaction transition state and the SN2 product. And on the other side, what we'll have is the E2 transition state and the E2 product, so that I'm going both forwards in time, both directions. It's thinking about an energy diagram in a slightly different way. Normally, we never do an energy diagram this way. There should always be a reaction coordinate, which always goes one direction in time. But we can think about two different energy diagrams and just backing them up to each other so that we can look at them in the same graph and see them in the same sort of way. The SN1 would give me a carbocation, and then, would give me a carbocation and then some product, which would generally be more stable. The E2 and the E1 would also be on there. So all four of these would compete, and whichever one had the lowest activation energy would be the one that that would be the major product. And Eric, your question also, this is a terrible diagram and I'm doing a terrible job here, but it goes to, if we think about sort of a Boltzmann distributions of energies and the different activation energies. So the activation energy for perhaps the E1, the activation energy for the SN2, the activation energy for an SN1, and the activation energy that may be for an E2. And yeah, I'll get all the products in varying degrees based on their activation energies, and the rate of each one of those chemical reactions would give a distribution of all of those products, and I would see them all. And I'm focusing on, right now, only one mechanism and one reaction and ignoring the rest. So you can imagine that my percent yields, if I were to write out my percent yields, and we go back to this chemical reaction, that my percent yields, when I say major, I may get something like 70% of this product, and I may get 10% of this product. And so where did the other 20% go? The other 20% went to all the other various products that I could make through the other mechanisms that I'm not focusing on, which are going to be minor in comparison to these two. So I hope that helps, Eric, and I hope that helps everybody else, even though my drawings were not the best there. But that's kind of where we're going. And when we get into chapter 9 and we start putting it all together, that's in essence what we talk about and spend most of our time talking about, is how do we decide which pathway a reaction goes. Tertiaries are generally going to go through unimolecular, creating carbocations. Primaries are generally going to go through bimolecular, which are SN2 and E2. And secondaries are going to go all different directions. Secondaries are going to be able to go unimolecular or bimolecular because their sterics are both low enough to go bimolecular and also it's stable enough to be able to produce carbocations. And so, yeah, we'll have all of those things happening all simultaneously. Last question. No, you're out of questions, dude. You've reached your quota. What temperature would this reaction be run at? Usually when we use the symbol that we say heat, that symbol is meant to be used as reflux. So this symbol generally can be inferred as reflux. And so what reflux means is different for different solvents. So if we're in methanol, then the boiling point of methanol is at 68 degrees Celsius. And so we would be running it at 68 degrees Celsius because you can't get hotter than that when you're refluxing a reaction. If we change the solvent and we're running it in ethanol, now the boiling point in ethanol is 78 degrees C. And so that heat symbol would mean 78. So in the absence of an actual temperature, when you see the symbol, the capital delta, which means reflux, assume that you're at the boiling point of whatever solvent you happen to run the reaction in. That's also a great question, Eric. Thank you. Okay.
Just real quick. I think it was just the drawing, but the activation energy on the first, the other diagram, the second step should just be a little bit lower in energy, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Also, there's another problem with this diagram that I did not address, which I should have, which is, I should fix it. I don't want to fix it. Let me see if I can take my time and do this.
These things get together, have to keep going.
Try again, Dina. I'm sorry.
Draw it correctly because I have to keep drawing this so many times now.
I'm sorry, Dina. I forget that you guys are trying to keep up with me and keep up with me in notes too. But remember too, I'm also posting the notes. So if you need to take a break and let your hand rest, you can always go back and catch them from the notes that I post online.
I know. I'm just so confused with all the different, like, wait, which one now?
Okay. So what I want to do is, let me draw something and I'll explain. Although I really do want to get to my next example. But let me fix this and show what I'm talking about. This product or starting material that had the leaving group, the iodine, when this guy comes off, it goes to a carbocation. And that carbocation was not the carbocation I originally drew. This came after the hydride shift. So there was an H that was here that we did a hydride shift on that took us to the next carbocation that was the allylic carbocation. And this allylic carbocation was more stable, was lower in energy than the other one. And so I have that level, and I have that level, and then I have my two different activation energies, and they go down to my two products, one which was more stable and less stable, the less stable one being this one. And the more stable one being that one. And this is what my energy diagram was missing. Was my step. And I'm going to have to pass my lines through these guys a little bit because I can't get them far enough apart. Or maybe I could. If I take all that and shrink it down, that was clever. I forgot that I could actually do that. Okay. Now this energy comes up and down to that guy. And up to that guy. So that's what we should have had. And what was missing was this step was missing in the previous one. Because I had the hydride transfer and I needed to account for the initial hydride transfer. And that was my activation energy. And that was my rate determining step was for the formation of the original carbocation. Before I actually had the hydride transfer in order to make the allylic carbocation. So now the energy diagram is correct. And the other carbocation that Alien had asked about was this one, which needs to come in here and just be a little bit lower. This would have been the hydride transfer that would have drawn that guy there. And then that would have gone off to some other product that would have been higher in energy. So this would be the tertiary and this is the allylic. Okay, and now that energy diagram has everything on it. Whew. Okay, I want to hit this other example though. We need this other example. Okay, let's do this. Let's take this material, and we will react it with acetonitrile at and water. So this is also an SN1 reaction, and it makes two products. The first product is direct substitution. And the other one is that. And what we see is that this one is major. We'll say this is cold. This is major under kinetic control. And that it has a K relative to the other one at about 2.5 times faster than the formation of the other product. And what's really cool is that if I take, and so that came about because when this group leaves and pops off, presumably it gets protonated there's probably a small amount of acid in the reaction in order to be able to do this. It gets protonated, and once it's protonated, it leaves and comes off, and then it gives the allylic carbocation, and that is in resonance with the primary allylic. And so that's where the two products come from, is from both of those two things. And the kinetic control being the one that forms the fastest, this is the largest partial positive. This is the most stable, or the major contributor that's there, which gives rise to the kinetic product. The other one being the minor, which gives rise to the thermodynamic, having the more substituted double bond. And if I take that and compare that to this product, so I'll have a chloride leaving group this time, and same reaction conditions. So we'll use an SN1 reaction, acetonitrile, CH3CN, water, and we'll do it cold. When this group comes off, it leaves behind a carbocation, that is the same allylic carbocation. And so the carbocation essentially is the same. And what that means is that I get the exact same products, even though the leaving group is in a completely different location. And that this is also the major kinetic product here. It has a slightly different rate because of the starting point. So the K relative in this case is 4.1 times faster. But the fact that they have the same carbocation, so this group here is identical in both, that's what's giving rise to these identical products. And even though the substrate looks different from the outset, they give the same products. And one more reaction. Let's take this and do the same reactant that I had in the first case. And we'll do acetonitrile, CH3CN, and water. But this time what we'll do is we'll heat it. As we heat this reaction, we get this product. And this becomes major. And when we look at these two products up against each other, it's an equilibrium really between what's happening with these, but the equilibrium is far shifted to the product side. It becomes 1 to 16 in terms of product ratios. So 1 to 16, essentially, with the major product being the more substituted double bond. And that puts us under thermodynamic conditions. So we can see how kinetic control, that really what this exemplifies is that these carbocations that are being created are identical carbocations, even though they come from different starting materials. The carbocation being identical allows for the identical products to be formed and for the same major product to be formed in both cases. When I switch the reaction conditions and I change the reaction conditions such that I go under thermodynamic conditions by heating it, I can make the more substituted double bond be the major product while still going through the same carbocation. So that's, to me, kind of exemplifies the other one a little bit, or is even a better example than the one that I showed before, because it's showing you that no matter where the leaving group leaves from, if you go through the same carbocation, you're going to get the same distribution of products essentially. And it also shows kinetic control going for the less substituted double bond versus thermodynamic control going for the more substituted double bond. So when I do things cold, cold gives me kinetic. And when I do things hot, the hot gives me thermodynamic. So that's what I'm linking together there. All right, how are we doing? Stunned silence. Oh, Anne's got it. Okay. Nicole's got it. So we got a couple of people. Caden, okay, cool. One more topic. One last page here in this chapter. And that is, we addressed the stereochemistry of SN2 reactions, but we never addressed the stereochemistry of SN1 reactions. So let's do stereochemistry. So the stereochemistry in an SN1 reaction, let's take an optically active material, and this will be an alcohol. So this will be a single isomer. And we'll say that this is optically active, meaning that it's single isomer, non-racemic. When I react this under SN1 conditions, we'll use H2SO4 and methanol. What's going to happen is, mechanistically, the alcohol is going to become protonated. We will go to the protonated leaving group. The leaving group leaves. As the leaving group pops off, the stereocenter is lost. It becomes sp2 hybridized and it becomes trigonal planar. In a trigonal planar, the carbon is flat with an empty p orbital. And the nucleophile presumably has equal opportunity to approach from the top as it does from the bottom, which means that the incoming methanol that's going to attack this carbocation can either come from the top of the reaction or can come from the bottom of the molecule to react. And when that happens, I get two different products. So the two products that come out of that then are one where the methanol attacked from the top and the one where the methanol attacked from the bottom. And then we have a deprotonation step that needs to happen. So some base is going to take that proton, giving the electrons back. Some base is going to take the proton, giving the electrons back. And we'll go to two different products. That arrow got carried away. So the two products that I get are one where the methanol has come in from the top, and one where the methanol has come from the bottom. And these two materials are diastereomers. That what has happened there is that the stereocenter undergoes both what is called inversion and retention. That I wind up seeing, because it was flat, I have equal opportunity of the carbocation being attacked from the top or the bottom. So that if I do this and I only have a single stereocenter, for instance, let's just do it on something that is like 2-butanol, and I do H2SO4 and methanol, and this is single isomer. When I get the product, I get a product that is racemic. Meaning that this is a mixture of the R and the S. Oops, that was not supposed to be an OH, but an O methyl. And that, and I don't know which one is R and which one is S. I need to figure it out real quick. 1, 2, 3, R. So this is the R and this one is the S. And I get a mixture of both. And they are 50-50. Because there's equal opportunity for attack from that carbocation from above and from below. And so I end up with enantiomers. If there's more than one stereocenter, such as the one that I did before, and the stereocenter here does not change, then I end up with a mixture of not enantiomers, as below, but diastereomers, because the other stereocenter is not participating in the chemical reaction, and I'm only getting a split at the other. So these two products, one of these products we would say is retention of configuration, meaning it has the same configuration as the starting material, and the other one is inversion. So whenever you have, almost always, whenever you have a carbocation, you wind up getting racemization at the stereocenter where the carbocation was, because you can have equal attack from above and from below the carbocation. And so you wind up with either mixtures of enantiomers or diastereomers, depending upon what your substrate was, every time you undergo a carbocation reaction. Okay, how is that going? Or how's that looking or sounding? Cool. Okay, so a couple of big differences between SN2 and SN1. In SN2, just to summarize, in SN2, this is governed by sterics. And it's sterics of the substrate. It is that primaries undergo reaction faster than secondaries, which undergo reaction a lot faster than tertiaries. So that's our rate in terms of the substrate. And that this is bimolecular. It's bimolecular and it is concerted. By concerted, we mean single step. And so the reaction energy diagram looks like that with a single transition state. They proceed by inversion of configuration. In the SN1 reactions, SN1s are governed by electronics. By that, we mean carbocation stability, not sterics. Rates for these reactions are based on the carbocation formation, where tertiary is faster than secondary, is a whole lot faster than primary in terms of the substrate. So they are reverse in their chemical rates. This is unimolecular, in that the rate only depends upon K times the concentration of R leaving group. And that these guys proceed it's unimolecular, and it's not concerted. This is stepwise. Such that when we look at the reaction, we go to an intermediate, which is the carbocation, before proceeding down to a product. So they always go through a carbocation intermediate before proceeding to the product. And stereochemistry-wise, these end up with racemic mixtures because I get attacked from above and below on a trigonal planar carbocation. So these guys give racemic products. Okay, so that's our quick little conversion. And I think that we could also put up here that our rate is equal to K times the concentration of R leaving group times the concentration of the incoming nucleophile. So that's an important component in that reaction as well. And our rate determining step, and our activation energy that is there. All right, that's our overview and sort of conclusion for chapter, was that 7? Which takes us into chapter 8, where we start the elimination reactions, and we'll start that on Monday. All right, so you guys have a quiz to do. The quiz is a carbocation quiz, appropriate for this chapter. And I also would like you to start doing the co-op, which is the carbocation co-op. Which will give you more practice in looking at carbocations and carbocation rearrangements and carbocation stabilities and all of that stuff. So you've got some homework to do now. And let me know. Any questions on today's lecture? You want me to hang around for a little bit? And if not...
I have a question.
Go for it, Finn.
Is the rate determining step always on the first reaction for SN1s?
Yes, the rate determining step on an SN1 will always be the rate of carbocation formation and the leaving group leaving. Yes, that is always true.
Okay, thank you.
So if there's any other questions, I'm happy to hang out and answer questions for a while. Remember, I also have office hours that start at 1:30. And other than that, this wasn't my best lecture. I always rank myself, think about my lectures afterwards. So I think I've got some room for improvement in this one, but hopefully I didn't confuse the crap out of you and you guys are doing okay. Go out, enjoy the weekend, have a good day, and I'll hang out for questions afterwards. So I'll be here if you want to hang on the line and go ahead and unmute and ask anything you got.
I just was wondering if I noticed on the website that you hadn't posted the lecture slides, and I was wondering if you could, for Monday, just so that I can see the assignment that's due for next week.
Yes, I will go and do that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened yesterday. I got lost somewhere yesterday. I'll get those posted, and I'll do that while I'm in office hours. I'll get those up today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome, Katrina.
So, real quick.
Yeah.
I know you're probably going to go over this later on in the semester, but what would govern whether the reaction would proceed as SN2 versus SN1? Like, what are some, like, really big aspects that would determine which one it would go, or which way it would go?
Okay. So, yes, that is a topic for later, but when we look at a substrate, well, let's do this. Substrate. Leaving group. Nucleophile. Solvent. Temperature. These are the five major factors that determine whether a chemical reaction will go SN1, SN2, E1, or E2. And these factors all need to be judged independently. And the problem is that there isn't a real good hierarchy in terms of how do I rank these to figure out whether something is going to go a particular direction. Generally, what I do is I put substrate at number one and say that that's my most important thing. But sometimes that can change. If I change some of the other variables, the rankings can change. So these rankings are conditional rankings. So don't get too caught up into these rankings right now. The leaving group and the nucleophile, I sort of rank together as number two, as being equally important. The solvent, I can't remember if I put temperature before solvent. I think it's three and four in the way that I generally rank things. So we can have secondaries, primaries, tertiaries. Primaries and secondaries are going to favor SN2. Secondaries and tertiaries are going to favor SN1. And it really depends on secondary as to what other factors are taking place within the reaction as to whether or not a secondary is going to go SN1 or SN2. When we start to look at nucleophiles, the stronger the nucleophile, the more likely you are to go in SN2. So better nucleophile, generally favors SN2 as opposed to SN1. But because the nucleophile doesn't really play into the rate law, it's more the substrate than it is the nucleophile. But if you have a really strong nucleophile, and what we find is things like RO minus is a better nucleophile than ROH, that anions tend to be better nucleophiles than neutral molecules. As far as the leaving group, the better the leaving group, the faster the chemical reaction. And generally, the better the leaving group, the more likely it is to go SN1. So better leaving group, this favors SN1. Temp-wise, temperature, high temp tends to favor SN1 over SN2 because you have enough thermal energy for the leaving group to leave. So low temp tends to favor SN2. But what is high and what is low, we haven't discussed yet because that is dependent upon different solvents and is also relative to the leaving group itself. So what is a high temp to one leaving group could be a low temp to another leaving group. For instance, if I have a tosylate, which is a really good leaving group, it could pop off at room temperature and I need to keep that thing in the fridge in order to keep the leaving group from popping off. And so room temperature could be high for that type of leaving group. But if I have another leaving group that is a chloride, that chloride could stay there at 80 degrees. And 80 degrees may be a relatively mild temperature for that. And it may not come off until I hit 120 or 150. So 150 might be a high temperature and 25 degrees might be a low temperature for a chloride. So it all depends on all these things being interrelated. And your answer, the answer that you're asking me is two lectures worth of material and a whole lot of examples. And another thing that I call the magic sheet. Let me show you where the magic sheet is. Oh, solvent also plays into this. But let's leave solvent. No, solvent's important. Polar aprotic favors SN1, while nonpolar favors SN2. And that has to do with the fact that the SN2 transition state, the transition state here is nonpolar. And so like dissolves like. Whereas the transition state in an SN1, the transition state is polar. And so again, like dissolves like. So polar aprotic solvents for polar transition states, aprotic solvents or nonpolar solvents for nonpolar transition states. So all of those factors kind of play into it. But Eric, what you're really looking for, I think, in order to make some of those decisions is, let me see if it's on the website. Additional resources. And there it is. Nucleophilic substitution elimination guidelines. So this is compiled in part from Carey and Sundberg, Advanced Organic Chemistry. And this guy is a two-page sheet that I call the magic sheet. And what it does is it breaks down substrate, solvent, nucleophile, leaving group, and the temperature, and tells you which factors are favoring substitution, secondary order, versus substitution, first order, and also the elimination reactions. And on the second page of this, it classifies all the nucleophiles, classifies the various nucleophilicity of nucleophiles, and the different solvents in which promote bimolecular versus unimolecular. It has all that data on it. And what we'll do is when we get into that chapter 9, where we're putting these all together, I hand out this sheet to everybody. And we sit down and we use the sheet in going over and looking at all of the different chemical reactions. So I think I've answered your question in part, maybe not satisfactorily, but it's just going to take a lot more work yet.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jason.
Yeah. I hope that was helpful. I hope that makes sense.
It was. Okay. I'll see you for lab.
Yeah. Sounds good. Anybody else with questions? How you doing, Dina? Okay, I'm going to guess that you stepped away.
Well, I'm just hanging up my screen now.
You're hanging in there?
Yeah, for a second. I'm going to see what you're saying about this.
You know what? I'm trying to hear you and your sound is really tweaky. I can't quite catch everything you're saying. It's almost as if we've got a super bad phone connection. How about we throw it in the chat? How about you type it to me?
Yeah. I'm having a bad connection. I had a quick question regarding the okay, I'll send you an email regarding it.
Okay, that sounds good. So I think I heard you're going to send me an email, that's going to be easier. Okay, let's do that. We'll do it through email and then I'll try to catch up. I wish I could hear you. I want to hear what you have to say, but send me an email. Make sure you get it to me and I'll respond to you. Okay, I hope you're doing well. Hang in there.
No.